When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
I have a funny story to share about working with clients and the strange things that you hear sometimes when collaborating with people who, are coming from wherever they're coming from. I was working on a comics project that was aimed at young people, and I was doing a whole bunch of different character designs, and some of them were people and some of them were animal characters. And one of the people on the team said, you know, children just don't relate to talking animal characters. And I shook my head. I was like, what? What are you talking about? Charlotte's Web. You can name like a dozen Disney movies with talking animal characters in it. Babe, Pig in the City, you know. Anyway, it was a funny moment where I was confronted with somebody's perspective on talking animal characters. And don't need to know how that conversation ended. It's just it's funny that I wanted to use that as a way to frame up this idea of like why I chose to do this project, Baron von Baer and the Case of the Two-Faced Statue, with talking animal characters, or as C.S. Lewis called them, clothed animals. I love that expression, clothed animals. And yeah, you know, it's like when I think of epic fantasy stories of the 20th century, you know, like I like Lord of the Rings just fine. As a matter of fact, I went through a period where I was like obnoxiously into it. Like I read The Silmarillion and was ready to talk anybody's ear off when those movies were coming out. Still mad that they didn't put Tom Bombadil in the movies. But I'll tell you what, I liked The Chronicles of Narnia way more, you know, and especially when that movie came out and there was that battle scene with all those animals running across the green field and it was daytime. It was daytime. It wasn't raining. Anyway, I'm getting astray. But like what made me love that story more is like the preponderance of talking animals. And this topic is actually inspired by a question given to me on the form at baronvonbaer.com/AMA, as in ask me anything. And the question runs as follows. I've noticed animals are a shortcut to mean wholesome, in quotes. Do you think storytelling tropes like this have an effect on the types of children's stories made? Now, I don't feel like I am learned enough to weigh in on a question that with that broad of a scope. What I can share, and hopefully it'll be helpful and satisfy some of the curiosity so generously provided by this listener, is how I think about them, what I think about them, why I choose to use them in my work. Because I don't know if animals are necessarily a shortcut to wholesome, although I do think that they open the door for grappling with difficult ideas in a way that feels more accessible. Like I think of, Spiegelman's Mouse, where he used animal characters to explore this really deeply difficult and tragic material. And then I'm also reminded, and I'll call this up again, this quote from Michael Mead. I used this in a recent TPD. He said, "It's interesting that old stories about wisdom will often involve animals, as if to say, we have to get out of our typical way of seeing ourselves in order to see both where we are trapped and where transformation might be found." I'm going to read that again. "It's interesting that old stories about wisdom will often involve animals, as if to say, we have to get out of our typical way of seeing ourselves in order to see both where we are trapped and where transformation might be found." That's Michael Mead of the... I'll link to his podcast. He has a great podcast on mythology and does these essays. I think about that. Like animal stories for me, like when I think about like mythology and folklore, you know, you have characters like Raven. You have, you know, all sorts of trickster animals in mythology. And when I even think of like the media that I grew up with, like things like Clash of the Titans, you know, the movie, I forget the guy who played Perseus, but he was like that 70s hunk. But there was Bubo the Owl who was helping him. And you bet I loved Bubo the Owl more than I loved Perseus. you know? Animal characters are cute, and maybe that's where, like, this word wholesome comes from. It's like, we see Boobo, and we see him, like, being brave. Like, I've talked about how Ewoks are, like, what I show up for Star Wars for. I like all the Jedi stuff and the lightsabers and all the, you know, interpersonal drama and all that stuff, but I'm really there mostly to see, like, am I gonna see a cute monster in this? And yeah, like, whenever I talk, like, when I think I've told before, like, the story when I was in a room full of eighth graders and somebody asked what's my favorite thing to draw, and I said cute things being brave, and I started talking about that scene in Return of the Jedi where the Ewoks are fighting all the stormtroopers, and then there's an explosion, we see two Ewoks fall down, and one gets up, and the other one doesn't get up, and I get choked up just thinking about it every time. And for me personally, this also, like, comes from, like, I'm a vegetarian because I think that animals are awesome and we should be kinder to them. And the thing about that is, like, when you do this long enough, you start to get, like, super hypersensitive to this. Like, the other night, I was just out on a nightly walk, and the cat came up to me that was meowing, and it was clearly, like, there were some fireworks going off, and it was scared, and it was, like, rubbing up my leg. I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta take care of this cat. I gotta find out who it belongs to. You know? Yeah, I'm a really light touch when it comes to animals. And for me, it's always been this way. I grew up in a very rural area. This little town called Beale City with not much of a population. I think the K-12 student body when I went there was 250 kids. There was maybe 20 to 22 students in my whole grade. It was, you know, roughly 7 miles to, like, my nearest friend to go to his house, you know. It was a lot like how they portray Kansas in, you know, The Wizard of Oz or in, you know, the Superman movies. It was because it was a rural community, it was a lot of farms, a lot of animals around, and I had a lot of cats growing up and dogs, and it's just like, there's just animals everywhere when I was a kid. And the first comic books I made featured all clothed animal characters. I was writing what I thought at the time were epic sci-fi stories, right? Like, so Silver and the Periodic Forces was one of the first completed comic stories I ever made. Like, it was like fourth or fifth grade, somewhere in the neighborhood. And it was a silver alien who had a glove that could summon warriors representing each of the chemical elements. Well, the silver alien was a lizard man, right? When I was a kid, I loved the He-Man cartoon, but my favorite character as a child was Lizard Man, who they never even made a toy of when I was a kid. I thought he was just so cool. It was like a half-man, half-lizard character. And a lot of the characters I made for my comics back then, you know, my house burnt down when I was, like, in high school, so I lost all of this material. But before that happened, I had, like, a binder with over 200 characters in it that I created. And I drew on one side of the paper the character, and on the back side of the paper, I wrote, like, sort of like a bio of them, and I did, like, a 3-panel comic strip just showing them doing something. And I don't remember all of them, naturally, but I do remember my main guys was a guy called Claw, who was a lizard man, a lot of lizard men in my comics, and his superpower, so it was like science fiction, but it was also superheroes, but again, no humans, only animals. Claw had like sort of an Indiana Jones kind of outfit, but his power was he could make his hands grow really big, kind of like Ms. Marvel, and his hands had big claws on it, so hence the name Claw. And Claw's son was Silver, who had the magic glove that could summon warriors representing each of the chemical elements. And then Claw's partner was a guy named Snaketooth, who was another lizard man. He was more like a snake man, who was a magician of some kind. He was like some kind of wizardy character. There was Fastfoot, who was another lizard man. What do you think his power was, right? There was a guy called Birdman. I wonder what kind of animal he was. And then there was a guy named Big Mouth who was a rhinoceros who could make his mouth grow big and he could shout really loud. So he was kind of like Black Bolt from the Marvel Comics. And then there's a character called Bones, Master of Lasers, and I don't remember what that character was. I only saw his name in a short story that I wrote that got like published in like a school thing when I was in elementary school and somebody shared it with me recently. And yeah, I don't know what he was, but I'm betting he was an animal, probably a dog. So I've always had an affinity for animal characters, but when I got into high school and started to like really take this idea seriously that I'm going to make comics someday, and remember, when I was in high school, it was the late 80s, early 90s, and comics at that time were largely Marvel and DC. There were like some independent companies like Mirage Studios. You had the beginning of Image Comics, but even Image Comics as an independent comics company was mostly superheroes. It was all rippling muscles and spandex, right? And I didn't have a problem with that. I didn't feel alienated by that in any way. I just felt like, well, that's what you do. I like Spider-Man. I like Spider-Man a lot, as a matter of fact. I'm going to be the next Spider-Man artist. And so I'm going to pivot to learn how to draw people well, because that's where the action is and that's where the excitement is, right? So by the time I was like in my late teens and beginning making comics, I largely put away the idea of doing animal character stories. But not long after that, like by the time I did my first like published miniseries in 2002, I was peppering my work with these little animal characters in the background. Because I never fell out of love with it. Thundercats, the Robear Burbles, oh my gosh. You want to watch me lose my stuff? Watch the episode, I think it's the third episode of the Thundercats TV show, where they meet the Burbles. Oh my God, I love them so much. Oh my gosh, they're so cute, and they're so sweet, and they're so wise in their way, even though they act kind of silly and they eat candy fruit. There's something about, to me, this is how I perceive it and how I think about it, is like, when I was a kid, I loved cartoons that presented me with characters who were absolutely fantastical, like Lizard Man, or like, you know, a cartoon, a Saturday morning cartoon I really enjoyed was Saturday Supercade, where it was all video game characters, or Transformers. Like, as a kid, I liked Spike fine in the Transformers show, but I really was there to like watch the robots look amazing, right? I wanted to be like those robot characters. I was there to experience something that was beyond being a human being. That's what I loved about Masters of the Universe, was that it was characters like Trapjaw, characters like Merman, characters like Orko, these people who didn't look like me. Now, we are living, at the time of this recording, in this wonderful time where more and more fiction is being made where kids of all different backgrounds can see themselves in the material. And I think that's absolutely wonderful. Do not mistake me. I think this is, it just keeps getting better, and I hope it keeps moving in that direction. But I'm talking about myself as somebody who consumed media as a young person. When any kind of live action show would come on a Saturday afternoon or after school, like a CBS after school special, and it was just kids just doing kid stuff, like having a clubhouse and maybe trying to solve some kind of neighborhood mystery kind of thing, I always punched out. I was so not interested in that. As a matter of fact, I was like just, it was almost like when the news would come on or something. It was just like, oh man, oh yeah, I don't want to watch a show about kids just doing kid stuff. I am a kid. I'm doing kid stuff. I'm here for the deep, rich fantasy of something like really imaginative and wild and surprising. I was there for novelty. Even G.I. Joe, which, you know, is about, you know, right, people, as it were, but they were all kind of super people, right? They all had a military specialty, and they went to remote and exotic locations. I talked about this recently, you know, this idea of like the three remote and dangerous locations. So that the G.I. Joe was like an army story, but it was mashed up with science fiction and fantasy in a really major way. There's episodes where they, you know, fight ghosts. They meet the Egyptian gods. It gets really wild and imaginative in that show as well. And that's what I was always there for. Now, when I got a little older, like 13, 14, yes, I discovered Robotech, which had a lot of like human relationship stuff in it. It was largely a soap opera with giant robots in outer space, but it had giant robots in outer space with giant blue-skinned aliens in outer space. So I always needed that. I didn't want to see, I was less interested in seeing myself on the screen as I was in seeing a Lizard Man I could project myself into. So that's my personal taste, and that's one of the reasons that I chose to make animals as characters in my book. Because I think I shared this recently, is this idea that when I was pitching the book around, the feedback I was getting is, this is great, this is imaginative, this is fun, I love the concept. Could you do it with kids, right? And my reaction was always like, well, that's exactly what I'm trying to get around. There are a lot of people who are way more qualified than me, with more rich and diverse backgrounds than me, who can speak to those childhood experiences that I cannot. I can certainly speak to the childhood experience of somebody growing up in a rural community who has some kind of issues around violence and use of power in a space where power is being discussed in this really kind of anachronistic way. And as a matter of fact, I have a draft of a book that I'm working on about that, like a fictionalized or fiction story that like is informed by a lot of my childhood experiences, sure. But this book, I want to use animals because anybody can see themselves in these animals. Baron von Baer doesn't represent any particular background other than scholarly person who loves to learn and gets really hung up on his sense of expertise. He knows who he is. He's done baking. He doesn't need to grow anymore. And then he gets shaken up a little bit and realizes, oh, I've got more growing to do. That's what's important, not whether he is from this background or that. Again, I'm not trying to hold one up as being better than the other. It's just different. It's just because I know that there were kids who, you know, like the Babysitter's Club books are great. And when Raina Telgemeier's first Babysitter's Club book came out in 2006, that was an electric moment for me. So I was like, oh my gosh, the book publishers know about comics and they're going to make more comics. Comics is going to be okay. And we desperately needed more kinds of comics at that time because really all we had was like superhero, sci-fi, fantasy, and manga. And manga, you know, brought in a whole bunch of new like genre representation, which was wonderful. But, you know, it's like, when Babysitter's Club came out, it was like, oh my gosh, there's going to be comics made for everybody else who isn't me, who loves to project himself into a lizard creature, right? I am a very, very tiny sliver of the constituency of readers out there, and that's who I'm making my book for, right? And for me, what the animal characters represented was a way to... And it's this way with robots, with any other kind of character who like is like some kind of like mythical, larger-than-life kind of creature, it's a way for me to try on different points of view and identity. It was a way for me to figure out who the heck I was as a child. And like I said, you know, it's like when I got older, yeah, I loved Spider-Man like so much that when I was 15 years old, I had like this ongoing competition with another kid in my class who turned out to be like my best friend in high school, but like we started out with like this really adversarial relationship over who loved Spider-Man more. Oh my gosh. Like only a teenager can do this, right? It's like as if like what are the stakes on this? It's nothing, but it was something that consumed us both. So much so that I remember I went to the comic store. It was when Spider-Man number 1 came out. It was the new Todd McFarlane series. It was in 1991, something in the neighborhood. And all the comic stores got like these pre-bagged or sealed bagged editions of Spider-Man number 1 with like a silver print background or something like that. It was printed in black and white on like silk with like a silver ink. And the store owner, when I came in, he was like, hey, I held this for you. It was just like a freebie they gave me. And I figured you love Spider-Man so much, you can just have it. And I remember like both. First, there was the thrill of like, oh, wow, he sees me. He knows what I love. But then there was like this moment of like, I can't wait to tell that other kid in my class. Because like I was given the authority by a higher authority, i.e. a comic shop owner, that I'm the biggest Spider-Man fan. And he was so mad. I remember my friend was so mad at me about that. Anyway, my point is that, yes, I loved Spider-Man, and Spider-Man was sort of seeing myself in him, right? Cishet white kid getting bullied at school for being different. Sure. But when I was little, when I was in elementary school, that was not as interesting to me. What was interesting to me was sort of these fantastical, imaginative creatures that looked nothing like me because it was a world I could step into. And I think I wouldn't have had the language for it when I was 11, but I think as an adult looking back and sort of processing it, I think there was something that was me having a sense of enjoying worlds on a mythical level. Worlds that felt like they were talking about something that was big and important and sort of universal to all human beings, but through these really lavishly, almost garish characters. And I think, again, I think of that Michael Mead quote, right? as if to say we have to get out of our own typical way of seeing ourselves in order to see both where we are trapped and where transformation might be found. I think I had a sense of that. And the only evidence I can point to is I remember the moment I discovered Greek and Norse mythology, it was like seventh grade, somewhere in the neighborhood. And it was, I mean, it was like electricity was in my body. I remember going to my dad and being like, oh my gosh, have you heard of this thing? These people in Greece had this whole like system of gods that they all worshipped. And, like, there's all these stories about them. Okay, let me tell you about Asclepius. Oh my gosh, I gotta tell you about Asclepius. My dad's like, yeah, I know. And I remember him saying, like, I think I went through something very similar to this when I was your age. You know? So I think, and probably like the superhero stories I consumed as a child, like, probably primed me for that kind of readiness to enjoy that. But also, I think the cartoons on television that I watched were all in that vein. They were informed by that kind of storytelling. And again, I didn't watch He-Man thinking, oh my gosh, I identify with Prince Adam. No, I identified with characters like Cringer. I remember something about Cringer really resonated with me. And it, like, even, here's another, this is like a side note, but I think it supports my general point here. I remember when I was nine or so, I remember thinking, like, just saying a word that refers to fear felt fearful. I'll explain what I mean. Like, if you said in my presence when I was nine the word terrifying, I felt like just saying the word evoked terror. It, like, almost called it into the room. Like, the spirit of terror would descend upon you just by saying the word terrifying. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience, but, like, horror, that was another one. I didn't like to say that word. Don't say horror, because that makes things scary. Like, the atmosphere will become slightly more horrifying just by saying the word horror. And I remember feeling validated by this when I watched He-Man, and Cringer would say things like, don't say terrifying, because it terrifies me, you know, and he starts shivering, because he's Cringer, he's afraid, he cringes. So, and he was also a talking cat, and I loved cats. I grew up around cats. I have cats today, you know. Animals are really, really cool. Animals are who they are, you know. They just exist. They just be, you know. A cat just is a cat. It's not going like, oh gosh, wouldn't it be better if I was a dog? It's not sitting around and like neurotically fidgeting over this stuff. And I know that's one of our superpowers as a species that has evolved and so on. It's cool that we can write poetry, and it's cool that we can make art, and we can like really explore meaning and epistemology and all these other things that like make our lives so like complex and weird and awesome. But there's also something really wise about an animal that is just what it is. It knows how to act on instinct. And that's something that we push out of our bodies at a very early age, because we're being told all the time, don't do this, don't do that, sit here, be quiet for an hour, and then when the bell rings, go into the next room, you know? And then I'm at that point in my life now, as a middle-aged man, where I'm trying to get back to that instinctual sense. That's another thing animals represent to me. And that's not really, like, a huge concept in the book, as I see it, but I feel like it's being, just like how when saying the word terror makes the air feel a little bit more terrifying, making it about animals evokes this sort of smell, this little bit of a hint of instinct is in the story as well. I hope. So I don't know if I really, you know, if I was in the room with the person who asked this question, I would actually say, like, I'd hold up my arm and I'd point at them and say, did that satisfy your curiosity, or do we need to go into it more? I can't do that because you're not here. But what you can do is, if this didn't satisfy your curiosity, you can ask a follow-up question via the form at baronvonbear.com/AMA, as in ask me anything. And if this thinking was interesting to you, if I at least made you like a little bit curious, I hope you'll check out Baron Von Bear and The Case of the Two-Faced Statue. It's my graphic novel for middle grade, but I think adults will like it too, because I think it's got a lot of cool, interesting stuff in it. I love this book so much, and I poured my soul into this thing, and I really hope people like it. You can find out more at baronvonbear.com. It's Indiana Jones in reverse. It's this little scholar who discovers that the good that he's been doing has been actually, it's been kind of causing harm, and he's got to figure out how to handle that. So instead of putting things in the museum, he's got the museum, all of the, you know, cursed spiritual objects get back out into the world. He goes out in the world to try to get them back and discovers, oh my gosh, they're not at all what I thought they were. How do you handle that? So baronvonbear.com. And thanks to everybody who supports it there. You know, there's action item buttons you can click there to do things to support this book. And thanks to everybody who does support the book. So, I'll be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily, and until then, remember everybody...
In today's story, Skeletor tried to conquer Eternia by using animals in an evil way. Animals, like all living things, should be treated with kindness and respect. I hope that those of you who have a dog or cat or maybe even a hamster remember that. When we have a pet, we also have a responsibility because they depend on us. But you can be sure of one thing, however much we love them, they return that love and more. Well, time for me to disappear. Bye.